Morning, ladies, gentlemen. The record will indicate all the jurors are present, counsel and the parties present. We're about to begin our closing arguments. Remember, during the course of the entire trial, including the argument phase, that the statements of the attorneys are not evidence. As far as the closing arguments are concerned, that's their opportunity to summarize for you what they believe the evidence has shown. So, without any further interruption, we'll begin, as is customary, with the plaintiff's opening argument. Mr. Pantone.
Closing statement.
Closing statement, okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the first opportunity I've had to talk to you directly in about 3 weeks. Because of the rules, of course, we couldn't communicate except for hellos and that sort of thing for the last 3 weeks. This is my first and last opportunity to talk to you about what I thought the evidence showed in this case. Let me first start off by thanking you all personally on my behalf and on behalf of my client, Tony Czarnik, for your attention during this trial, this lengthy trial. I know there were portions I'm sure were tedious, portions were tedious to me, but I appreciate you paying attention, hanging in there, and I appreciate the service that you are rendering in this case. So I thank you on my behalf and on behalf of my client. I want to refocus your attention back on the reasons that were given to Dr. Czarnik for his termination as research fellow. Those reasons that he was given were failure to meet the written goals that we looked at, the 30, 60, 90-day, and year goals. Those were the reasons for the termination. And again, he was terminated from his position as research fellow. The goals are really key in this case, and I'm going to spend a good deal of my time, we did in the trial, and I'm going to be spending some of my time today talking about those goals. The issue for you is going to be, are those goals reasonable, as Illumina contends, or are those goals unreasonable, and were they a setup as an excuse to fire Dr. Czarnik? That's a key issue in the case. Let me spend a couple of minutes talking about the issue of work ethic and work hours. The defense spent a lot of time on that issue in this trial. You'll recall a number of witnesses said Tony Czarnik doesn't have the same work ethic as John and Mark. Tony Czarnik doesn't work the same number of hours as John and Mark. I want to remind you that this so-called problem concerning Dr. Czarnik's work ethic, that allegedly arose in the summer of 1998. That was 2 years and 3 months before he was fired for allegedly not meeting his goals. Again, this so-called problem arose back in 98 and 99. And yet, there's not a single memo, there's not a single letter, there's nothing in Dr. Czarnik's personnel file, nothing that was given to Dr. Czarnik that substantiates that there were any performance problems in this point in time. You remember when John Stupnagel talked about Dr. Czarnik back in the summer of 1998 and subsequently. He used terms like Dr. Czarnik was failing miserably, that he was an incredibly poor performer, that he was contributing absolutely nothing to the company. I'm sure you recall that testimony. We submit that if that were true, if that were really true, if Dr. Czarnik was a miserable failure who was contributing nothing to the company, wouldn't you have expected John Stupnagel to at least begin to look for a new CSO? He told you he never even began looking for a new CSO. If he was a miserable failure, if he was contributing nothing, don't you think John Stupnagel would have mentioned it at a board of directors meeting? He was having these meetings every 2 months, yet he told you he never raised this so-called problem even once to the board of directors. If he was failing miserably, as Dr. Stupnagel indicated, wouldn't you expect that there would be something, some note, some reference in Dr. Czarnik's file to this problem? And yet, as you know, there's nothing. There's nothing until 2 years later, and only after Dr. Czarnik complained about discrimination. You don't see any counseling memo, any warning memo, any documentation about an alleged performance problem. Nothing until after he complained about discrimination. On the other hand, what we do have, what you did hear in terms of Dr. Stupnagel's testimony, was when he read from his handwritten notes. You will recall, these are the notes he made about his first major crisis as acting president. He read from those notes. Those notes were taken in January of 1999. And his notes say, and I'm quoting here, "Confident I've hired the right R&D managers." He told you that included Dr. Zernick. So despite anything you may have heard from Dr. Stupnagel in this trial, his own handwritten notes corroborate, as of January of 1999, Dr. Stupnagel was confident he hired the right guy in Dr. Zernick. So, ladies and gentlemen, even though Illumina spent a lot of time on this issue talking about things like who took longer lunches, I submit that you shouldn't be distracted by that testimony. You should focus on the real issues in the case. The issues are discrimination, retaliation, and whistleblowing. Now, with respect to discrimination, I told you when I opened the case in my opening statement that we are not claiming in this lawsuit that Dr. Zernick was involved in everything, in 100% of the activities, before he disclosed his depression. We're not saying he attended every single solitary meeting. He was involved in every single business deal. Nor are we saying that after the disclosure, he was excluded from everything. He didn't have anything he was assigned to after disclosure of depression. What I did say we would prove, and what I believe we did prove, is that after the breakdown, Dr. Zernick was excluded from meaningful and important activity relating to the company. He was given some job duties. He continued to have some job duties. But he was excluded from meaningful and important things that were going on at the company. The most important things going on at the company. I've prepared a PowerPoint slide to try to summarize some of the things that Dr. Zernick was excluded from after he disclosed his depression. These are exclusions while John Stupnagel was still the acting president. The first point is, after the disclosure, Dr. Zernick had no further involvement in genomics. He was only involved in the application called the Onos. You heard at trial that genomics is the key business application for Illumina. It's the focus of the entire company. They made a decision to focus on genomics. Before the depression was disclosed, Dr. Zernick was involved in genomic business activities. After the disclosure, no involvement in genomics. He was relegated to the Onos, which you heard from several witnesses was a low-priority item at Illumina compared to genomics. You heard that this deal with ABI, a collaboration with ABI, was the single most important business collaboration that Illumina had. At this time, it still is the single most important business collaboration, the ABI deal. Even though we heard ABI became interested in Illumina because of Dr. Zernick, even though the product that was going to be delivered to ABI was something that Dr. Zernick was familiar with and had responsibility for, called the Array of Arrays, despite that, Dr. Stupnagel decided that he and Mark Chi would be the persons who worked on the ABI deal, and that he and Mark Chi would be the persons who got the stock grant. Next, please. Opinions on scientific matters not solicited or respected. This concerns these ad hoc business strategy meetings that there's been some testimony on. These were meetings that were held on an as-needed basis. Dr. Zernick explained to you, before he disclosed depression, he was actively involved. His opinions were solicited. He interacted with his co-founders. After disclosure, he was there. He was physically at meetings, but he wasn't asked for his opinions. His opinions weren't respected when they were offered. Next, please. Dr. Zernick was not involved in the Series C financing. Financing is obviously a major activity for senior managers. You remember there was talk about the Series B financing. That was before the breakdown. Dr. Zernick was involved in the Series B financing. He was involved with the strategy meetings. He was involved in discussions with venture capital firms. He was intimately involved in the Series B financing. Yet, the next round of financing, which occurred after disclosure of depression, Dr. Zernick was not asked to be involved in any way, shape, or form. Next, please. Not involved in the recruitment of chief executive officer. Again, this would have been one of the most key activities going on at a senior management level, to be identifying who the new boss is, who the new CEO is. Turned out to be Jay Flatley, as we know. Dr. Zarnik was excluded from recruiting, interviewing, strategizing with respect to who would be the new chief executive officer of the company. Now, again, ladies and gentlemen, these items are major, important things that Dr. Zarnik was excluded from. These are fundamental to what a senior manager at a company like Illumina would do. Dr. Zarnik was excluded after he disclosed his depression. Let me speak to you about the issue of Jay Flatley's clean slate. You recall, I made a point about this in opening, very careful to ask Mr. Flatley repeatedly whether, when he came on board at Illumina, when he started as the new CEO of the company, did he start with a clean slate or did he have preconceived notions about Dr. Zarnik? Now, remember, Jay Flatley was brand new to the company. He was taking over for John Stuepnagel. He's taking over a management team that John Stuepnagel had been managing for more than a year. He didn't know these people that he was taking over, his new management team. Jay Flatley tells you that he heard nothing in the way of background. He was given nothing in the way of a briefing on any members of his management team, including Dr. Zarnik. I'm not sure if that makes sense to you, that the new CEO taking over a brand new management team to have no discussions with the prior guy who is running the show for more than a year? That's what Mr. Flatley claims. No briefing, no discussion, no background about Dr. Zarnik. Now, bear in mind that only 6 months earlier, before Jay Flatley started, Dr. Zarnik suffered the breakdown. John Stuepnagel had actually discussed replacing Tony Zarnik as CSO. It only happened a few months before Mr. Flatley arrived as the new CEO, yet Illumina claims John Stuepnagel didn't breathe a word about this to Jay Flatley. Ladies and gentlemen, if Jay Flatley really had a clean slate, if he was starting from ground zero with respect to Dr. Zarnik, then how does he explain that lunch that he had with Larry Bach? Remember, Larry Bach was the board member who showed his videotaped deposition. Larry Bach testified that at this lunch that he had with Jay Flatley told him there were performance problems with Tony Zarnik, and he was considering making changes. That's what Larry Bach testified to. So the date of that lunch is extremely important. We showed you during trial Exhibit 96, which is Jay Flatley's receipt for this lunch. He only had one lunch with Larry Bach. This lunch that he had with Larry Bach occurred November 4th, 1999. That was only 2 weeks after Jay Flatley came on board at Illumina. Jay Flatley started at Illumina October 18th. 2 weeks later, he has a lunch with a board member, and he tells the board member 2 weeks into the job, there are performance problems with Dr. Zarnik, and I'm considering making changes. Now, did you hear any evidence with respect to anything that happened in the first 2 weeks of Jay Flatley's employment that would have caused him to meet with a board member and tell a board member there's performance problems with Zarnik, I'm considering making changes? What happened during those 2 weeks that so alarmed Jay Flatley that he would raise this issue with a board member? Nothing happened during those 2 weeks. Even according to Mr. Flatley, there were no performance problems at all in that 2-week period. So why would Jay Flatley be having lunch with a board member 2 weeks into the job and telling him he's considering making changes? Because he didn't start with a clean slate. No way. It's impossible, given this lunch. Now, this practice of excluding Dr. Zarnik from important and meaningful business activities continued after Jay Flatley came on board. We prepared a slide to address the ways in which Jay Flatley excluded Tony Zarnik. First point, Jay Flatley never consulted Tony Zarnik for a briefing on the company's science and experiments. Remember, Jay Flatley is brand new to the company. He doesn't know the company's science. Who is the chief science officer at that point in time? Dr. Zarnik. Yet Jay Flatley never even bothered to meet with Dr. Zarnik to get a briefing on the company's science or the experiments it was conducting. Next, please. Dr. Zarnik wasn't involved in recruiting a new board member who arrived shortly after Jay Flatley. This was an individual named George Post. You heard in trial that Mr. Post had specific scientific background. That's why they wanted him on the board of directors. Jay Flatley got Mark Chee and John Stuopnagel involved in interviewing George Post. Didn't get Dr. Zarnik involved at all in the recruitment of this new board member. Next, please. Not given appropriate recognition as founder. If you remember anything from this trial, I'm sure you'll remember that point. We saw examples, numerous examples, of Jay Flatley not recognizing Dr. Zarnik as a founder of the company. The first being that slide he showed at the presentation in January of 1999. Slide says, company founded by John Stuopnagel and Mark Chee. Where did he get that information? Somebody had to tell Jay Flatley who the founders were. Now, you recall, Jay Flatley said this was just an error or an oversight. But ladies and gentlemen, we showed you that this so-called error was repeated again and again by Jay Flatley. Next, please. Key scientific job responsibilities taken away. Again, this happened in January of 2000, just a few months after Jay Flatley came on board. Jay Flatley took away at least two important job responsibilities from Dr. Zarnik. They both happened to relate to decoding. They were taken away from Dr. Zarnik and assigned to other people in January of 2000. Next, please. Not involved in recruitment of the new chief scientific officer. Again, you recall Dr. Zarnik wasn't asked to be involved in recruiting the new CSO, even though he specifically, on at least two occasions, asked, "Can I please be involved in this activity?" He was excluded. Next, please. Then there was the attempt to significantly reduce Dr. Zarnik's stock when he became research fellow. Let me say at this point that it's clear from the evidence that Dr. Zarnik volunteered to step down as chief science officer. We're not hiding from that fact. It turns out he wasn't being used as a real chief science officer for months, but he did volunteer to step down. Jay Flatley accepted that offer. We accept that. What was discriminatory at this point in time was Jay Flatley's attempt to slash Dr. Zarnik's stock. You may recall that Jay Flatley tried to buy back 167,000 shares, which was about 60% of Dr. Zarnik's remaining stock, tried to buy it back when he made Dr. Zarnik a research fellow. He wasn't able to buy it back only because Dr. Zarnik refused to sign that new employment contract. What's interesting is the reason Jay Flatley said that he was trying to cut Dr. Zarnik's stock was that he was taking a lesser position. He was going from chief science officer to research fellow, so he thought a cut in the stock would be appropriate. Yet we heard when Mark Chee testified that very recently Mark Chee also took a similar change in his job duty. He went from being a VP. He became a research fellow. Dr. Chee told you that the company didn't attempt to buy back one single share of stock when he became a research fellow. Clearly treated differently. Dr. Zarnik, Jay Flatley tried to buy back 167,000 shares when he became research fellow. Mark Chee, zero shares. Next, please. Dr. Zarnik was not involved in the drafting of the S-1 registration statement. He was not involved in the planning for the initial public offering. Clearly, these two activities were important. They were among the most important things that were going on at the company. They may be the most important things that will ever go on at Illumina, and Dr. Zarnik was excluded from these activities. So I just tried to summarize for you some of the major ways in which Dr. Zarnik was excluded, both by John Stuopnagel and by Jay Flatley. This takes us up to the point in time where Dr. Zarnik became a research fellow. Now, I'd like you to focus on what was the situation when Dr. Zarnik became a research fellow. That point in time is really important to this case. What was the situation? He was taken out of chief science officer, and he was put into a brand new position, research fellow. He was reporting to David Barker. You recall that? And that made sense. Dr. Zarnik's job duties were purely scientific. It made sense he'd report to who? Chief Science Officer, and he had worked out a set of written goals with his new boss, David Barker. That was the situation when Dr. Zarnik first became a research fellow. So what changed? You have to examine what changed from the point in time Dr. Zarnik was made research fellow to the point in time he was given goals and ultimately fired. There weren't, at that point in time, any performance issues, even according to the defense. What was Dr. Zarnik doing when he first became research fellow? Testimony was he was helping David Barker with the transition to becoming the new CSO. Dr. Barker testified that Dr. Zarnik was helpful in that process, that he was cooperative, that he was professional. So even according to the defense, there were no performance issues after Dr. Zarnik became research fellow and when David Barker was still his boss. So what changed? What changed between the time that Tony Zarnik was a research fellow reporting to Barker until the time that Jay Flatley said, "No, I'm taking over as your supervisor"? Ladies and gentlemen, the only thing that changed in that time frame is that Dr. Zarnik began to complain about discrimination. That's what happened in April of 2000. Dr. Zarnik was made research fellow in March. In April, he starts complaining about discrimination. And in May, Jay Flatley takes over as his new supervisor and assigns him new goals. We showed you three emails in April of 2000. Three separate emails where Dr. Zarnik complained about discrimination. All these emails were sent in April. Now, what was Illumina's response to Dr. Zarnik's complaint of discrimination? What did they do to respond to his complaint? I can tell you what they didn't do. We know that they didn't conduct any investigation into the complaint. You'll find out when Judge Prager reads you instructions, when he instructs you on the law, you'll learn that the law requires employers to investigate complaints of discrimination. The law requires the companies do immediate and prompt investigations into complaints of discrimination. That didn't happen here. They didn't follow the law. They didn't even follow their own company policy on this point. You'll recall Deborah Flamino, the human resources manager. She testified that company policy is, if a supervisor learns about discrimination, what's the supervisor supposed to do under company policy? Supervisor is supposed to report it to human resources, and human resources is supposed to conduct an immediate and prompt and thorough investigation. In this case, Jay Flatley completely ignored that company policy. So instead of investigating, what did he do? In May of 2000, he did three things. He gave Dr. Zarnik a counseling memo on May 4th, first counseling memo he ever got. He reassigned Dr. Zarnik's reporting relationship. You are no longer reporting to David Barker, you are reporting to me now. And third, he changed the goals that Dr. Zarnik had worked on with David Barker, and he put Dr. Zarnik on what he called a performance plan. But again, there were no performance issues as research fellow. Why would Jay Flatley, shortly after Dr. Zarnik complains about discrimination, put him on a performance plan as research fellow? There were no performance issues at that point in time. You'll hear also when Judge Prager instructs you on the law that timing is important. Timing is critical in these cases. So bear in mind that all these things I just mentioned, the first counseling memo, the change in reporting relationship, the redoing of the goals and putting him on a performance plan, those all happened shortly after Dr. Zarnik complained about discrimination. Let's take a look at the goals, please. Exhibit 227. You know by now these are the actual written goals that were assigned to Dr. Zarnik. Again, because of Illumina's relying on his, Dr. Zarnik's, alleged failure to meet these goals, these goals are critical to your determination of this action. Now, you recall that when Jay Flatley testified, he was adamant, absolutely adamant, that when he assigned these goals on May 19th, he hadn't yet decided to fire Dr. Zarnik. Remember when he said that? He hadn't yet decided. He was hopeful Dr. Zarnik would be able to meet these goals. I'll come back to this point later on in this presentation because I don't believe that that's the case. I believe the evidence, ladies and gentlemen, will show these goals were unreasonable, unattainable, and were designed to set Dr. Zarnik up for failure. In particular, the second goal, the goal we've spent some time on during the trial, binary oligo encoding. I prepared a chart that I think helps graphically demonstrate how unreasonable this goal was. This chart depicts what Illumina did as a company. This is the section in blue. I'll show you in a minute what the company was asking Dr. Zarnik to achieve with respect to binary oligo encoding. You remember that the entire company was devoted toward decoding efforts. You heard plenty of testimony about that. Decoding was key to Illumina's technology, key to Illumina's success, and Illumina was using Mark Chi's method of decoding. We've shown here what the company was able to accomplish in terms of their decoding experiments. Remember these decoding experiments? The 16-bead experiment, the 128-bead experiment, the 768-bead experiment? These were a series of experiments that were worked on by many scientists. This is the combined effort of all the company's scientists working together as a team, working on this issue of decoding. You heard that the results were that the company spent about 6 months. The bottom line on this chart depicts the months that were spent on this activity. This axis is to show the number of beads that were involved in these feasibility experiments. The entire company working together as a team, numerous scientists, 6 months working on the 16-bead experiment. Then you heard testimony that they took approximately 9 months to work on the 128-bead experiment, from months 6 to 15. Then finally, for most of the year 2000, the company, many scientists working together, were working on the 768-bead experiment. That would take us from month 15 to the end of 2000. So this is from the beginning of the company's research, when they first got their laboratory, to more than 2 years later. They were still working on the 768 feasibility. Let me show you what Dr. Zarnik... These numbers are so crazy, it was hard to even fit them onto this chart. We did the best we could. In 30 days, using a different method of decoding, in 30 days, Dr. Zarnik was being asked to show feasibility for 16 beads. In 60 days, approximately 2 months, he was being asked to show feasibility for 256 bead types. And then 3 months, 90 days, Dr. Zarnik was being asked to show feasibility for 4,096 different bead types. He was asked to do this working alone, using a brand new method of decoding. He was being asked to do something that the entire company, all the scientists working together as a team from the inception of the company, was not able to do. He was asked to do it in 90 days. Remember I asked John Stuepnagel, did the company ever do a 4,096-bead experiment? Of course, the answer was no. Then, if you look at the one-year goal, we've been referring to that number as approximately 1 million codes. It's actually 1,048,576 codes. I'm told by the person who made this chart that in order to depict in scale what that million goal number would be, it would require us to blow through about 10 floors of an office building. Obviously, we weren't able to depict that in any meaningful way except to show this arrow. It would be astronomical. So I think the evidence is pretty clear. What Dr. Zarnik was being asked to do was unreasonable in terms of numbers and in terms of time. Now, even though these goals were unreasonable, in particular the second goal, we've just reviewed the numbers of the time frames. By the way, I forgot to mention something I pointed out in the trial. Somebody tacked on to the third goal this submit a grant application. I don't think that was coincidental. I think they knew this was the issue that caused Dr. Zarnik's breakdown in the first place. He detested writing grants. On top of those unreasonable goals, I don't think somebody would tack on a grant application. Even though the evidence shows these were unreasonable, Dr. Zarnik did make some progress toward these goals. He worked to try to tackle the goals as best he could under the circumstances. We showed you numerous emails that Dr. Zarnik submitted to Jay Flatley where he reviewed his progress toward the goals. Those are in evidence. We showed you that self-evaluation form that Dr. Zarnik submitted. And that just wasn't a self-serving, I'm doing great self-evaluation form. That form, as we showed you, had 20 items listed on it. I encourage you to take a look at it in the jury lounge. It's Exhibit 320. There's an accomplishment section in Exhibit 320. It lists 20 specific things that Dr. Zarnik did in terms of working toward his goals and progress that Dr. Zarnik made in working toward his goals. On the day of his termination, Dr. Zarnik testified that Jay Flatley asked him for everything he has. Give me every conceivable thing you have that showed the work you did on the experiments. And he submitted a package of approximately 50 pages into Jay Flatley's mailbox on the day of termination. We know it didn't matter because these goals were designed in the first place for failure. Let me speak briefly about the whistleblowing claim in the case. You recall that experiment, or demonstration rather, that Mark Chi did up here where he mixed different colors into various bottles? I suppose that was intended to show you that there was nothing wrong with the experiment. I trust that's not the conclusion you reach from that little demonstration. Ladies and gentlemen, all of the scientists who testified about the 768 Decode experiment, every single one of the scientists who testified, said there was something wrong with the experiment, and the experiment had to be redone. You don't redo good experiments. Something was seriously wrong with this experiment. You heard from Kevin Gunderson, who is the lead scientist on this 768 experiment. He told you that there was something seriously wrong with this experiment. You recall the memo. Will you put the memo up, please? 354. You recall this was a memo that Dr. Gunderson wrote about a year after the experiment was done. He says in the summary section that the results, rather that the quality and accuracy of the data, may have been somewhat compromised by the mix-up in a lot of dye. He was the lead scientist on this experiment. When he testified in person, he told you he knew something was wrong with the experiment. He wasn't getting the results he thought he should get. When he found out about the mislabeled dye, he said, "That's it. That's why I wasn't getting the proper results." And he told you that he, the lead scientist on this experiment, he could draw no conclusions from that experiment with respect to the number of beads that could be decoded. He's the lead scientist. He told you it wasn't until after we did the experiment again, until after we ran it, after the roadshow, that any meaningful data was obtained regarding the number of bead types. So I think the consensus of the scientific evidence in the case was that there was something seriously wrong with this experiment because of the mislabeled dye. Take a look at Exhibit 355.
Which exhibit is this, counsel?
355. I'm showing you this because I think it's very important that in quarter four of 2000, that's after the roadshow, after Dr. Zarnik was fired, the goal was to decode how many beads? 500 beads. The goal was only 500 because the 768 decoding experiment was not effective. Now, in terms of Dr. Zarnik's whistleblowing, Dr. Zarnik testified that he spoke with Mark Chi about the mislabeled dye issue. You recall that. He found out about the mislabeled dye. He went to Mark Chi. Mark Chi was the right person to talk to because he was in charge of the decoding effort. He was Kevin Gunderson's boss, and Mark Chi was in charge at Illumina during the roadshow. Jay Flatley sent out a memo during the roadshow, "Mark Chi is in charge." So he was the right person to go to. Dr. Zarnik told you, "I went to Mark Chi, told him about the mislabeled dye issue, questioned him about the issue." He told Mark Chi, "You need to contact the roadshow team. You need to tell them about this problem, and not to do that, failing to do that, could constitute fraud on investors." That was Dr. Zarnik's testimony. Mark Chi didn't deny that that conversation took place. Mark Chi was adamant about a lot of things in this case, as were several of the defense witnesses, but I asked him two or three times about that conversation, and each time he simply said, "I don't recall." I said, "You don't recall, or are you denying the conversation?" He repeated, "I simply don't recall." It's important that Mark Chi didn't deny that that conversation took place. We also showed you in the course of the trial several emails that Zarnik sent out about this problem, the decoding problem. He sent an email to David Walt. That's the email that David Walt said he only read the first paragraph of. He sent that out. He sent an email to Mark Chi and to Jay Flatley on the subject of decoding problems. Now, Illumina says that the decoding had nothing to do with Dr. Zarnik's termination. Any concerns that Dr. Zarnik may have had about decoding had nothing to do with the termination. I don't think that's the case. I don't think you can find that that's the case. You'll recall those notes that Jay Flatley wrote in conjunction with the discussion he had with Jennifer Kearns. I'm sure you remember these notes. These are notes that Mr. Flatley and Miss Kearns talk about on the telephone. It's essentially a script for what to say to Dr. Zarnik at his termination. The first point on these notes states, "I understand you have expressed some strong opinions in the last few days about this." Jay Flatley told you he made statements, all the other statements on these notes, except for that one. You are going to have to decide whether that's credible or not. These notes were prepared in anticipation of a meeting. Miss Kearns and Jay Flatley discussed what would be said to Tony Zarnik at the termination meeting. Dr. Zarnik remembers these statements being made. They are on Jay Flatley's notes. I think that's compelling, ladies and gentlemen. The decoding and the terms Dr. Zarnik expressed had something to do with his termination. I want to take a few minutes to talk to you about the verdict form in this case. This is the actual verdict form, a blow-up of the verdict form you will have in the jury room. These are the questions you will be asked to decide in this case. Now, rather than focusing your attention on the exact, all the language in the verdict form, I'm not going to take you through every question. I just want to point out a few things that I think will be helpful in understanding the verdict form when you deliberate. The first thing is the questions are divided up into three different sections in terms of liability. You are asked questions about disability discrimination, you are asked questions about retaliation, and you are going to be asked questions about termination and violation of public policy. That's the same thing as whistleblowing. Now, there are three separate claims in the case. One thing you need to know is you are to decide each one of these claims separately. The fact that you may find in favor of one party on one claim, it doesn't necessarily mean that you must find in favor of the same party on any other one. They are separate and independent claims, and you decide them separately. There's a phrase that's used repeatedly in the verdict form, and that's asking you whether you find that the termination or other adverse action was in whole or in part caused by some illegal factor, disability or retaliation or whistleblowing. You are being asked to find whether Illumina took action in whole or in part for certain reasons. Now, in whole or in part means that in order to find liability, you've got to find that, for example, discrimination played a role in the decision to terminate. In whole or in part means you don't have to find that was the only reason for the termination, or that was the only reason for any other action taken against Dr. Zarnik. All you need is to find that it was a contributing factor in the decision, because employers can have multiple reasons for termination, or have multiple reasons for any employment action. You just need to find that the illegal reason played a role in the decision to terminate. Now, because I told you there are three separate claims, I want to show you two jury instructions that you are going to be given about two of the claims. When the closing arguments are over, Judge Prager will be reading this instruction along with many others. But I want to highlight something about this retaliation claim. The retaliation claim is the claim that Dr. Zarnik was fired in part because he complained about discrimination. It's important to note, because this is a separate claim, separate from the other two, that in order to prevail on this claim, Dr. Zarnik does not have to prove that he was actually discriminated against. In other words, conceivably, you could find that Dr. Zarnik wasn't discriminated against, but was retaliated against. Proving actual discrimination is not a necessary element of the retaliation. All you have to find is that Dr. Zarnik had a good faith belief that he was being discriminated against, and that Illumina fired him for or took other action against him, in whole or in part, for that reason. Similarly, on the whistleblowing claim, we can't prove to you that Illumina actually used the pretty picture on the roadshow. We're not going to be able to prove that. We didn't prove that in the case. But legally, that's irrelevant. This instruction tells you why. In order to prevail on the whistleblowing claim, Dr. Zarnik does not have to prove that Illumina actually did disclose information from this experiment. All we need to prove, and I believe we did prove, is that Dr. Zarnik had a reasonable belief that Illumina may have used or was planning to use this information. He raised those concerns, and Illumina took action against him in whole or in part because he raised those concerns. Employers may not retaliate against employees who reasonably blow the whistle, whether or not a violation of law actually occurred, which means in the whistleblowing claim, you need to decide whether Dr. Zarnik had a reasonable belief that the information being sent to the roadshow was faulty and that Illumina took action because of that. Let me conclude this portion of my closing. I'm going to save some time to rebut what Ms. Kearns may have to say. Going back to the issue of the goals, going back to the issue of whether Jay Flatley, whether he gave those goals to Tony Zarnik on May 19th of 2000, was that set up? Were those legitimate goals, or were they set up, designed for failure? Ladies and gentlemen, if you had any doubt, any more doubt after looking at the graph that we showed you in terms of the unreasonableness of the goals, in terms of their numbers, in terms of the time frame, in terms of the fact that Dr. Zarnik had to work alone, if you have any doubt whatsoever this was a setup, I want to show you one more document that's in evidence. Can you call up 223, Exhibit 223? This is a fax sent by a lawyer in Washington, D.C. to Jay Flatley and John Stulpnagel. You saw this during the trial. This is a markup of the S-1 registration statement. Notice the date of the fax, May 18th of 2000. Now, the date the goal sheet that was assigned to Dr. Zarnik, May 18th of 2000, same day, given to Dr. Zarnik the next day, May 19th of 2000. Flip forward to page 33 of the exhibit. We have a blow-up of it, too. There's a lot of writing on this. There's a reference here to Dr. Zarnik, and there's a reference to Rich Pytolewski. And you recall Jay Flatley actually told Rich Pytolewski he was being terminated. He was the other senior manager who was actually terminated. Next to both Rich Pytolewski's name and Dr. Zarnik's name, you find this asterisk. Look at the language for the asterisk. Let me draw your attention. This note says, "Modify Zarnik and Pytolewski to reflect terminations." Why would a lawyer in Washington, D.C. be sending Jay Flatley a fax with notes saying that this document is to be modified to reflect Zarnik and Pytolewski's termination? See the date of the fax? May 18th of 2000. The very next day, May 19th of 2000, Dr. Zarnik was given these goals. I think the inference from that language on the same day, modified to reflect termination, is compelling evidence these goals were designed as a setup from the very beginning. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pantone.
May we take our morning break?
Yes, we'll take our morning recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 25 minutes after 10 o'clock. Please remember the admonition not to form or express any opinions about the case. Do not discuss the case among yourselves or with anyone else. We'll be in recess until 10:25. 10:25.